goal that this bill has been tabled before us, I wish to make this few comments that in 1995, South Africa became a state party to the Convention on the Prohibition of Restrictions on the Use of Certain Conventional Weapons which may be deemed to be excessively injurious or to have indiscriminate effect. Now we all know that it should recall this bill the CCW. This bill is seen as part of the international humanitarian law, which is a set of rules that seeks to limit the effects of armed conflict on both combatants and non-combatants. And we also know that Article 14 of Protocol 2 of the Convention requires all states to enact 11 legislation, domestic legislation, to give full effect to the Convention. And in South Africa, we are doing so through this process to make sure that we do have a domestic legislation to give full effect to the Convention. And Section 231(4) of the Constitution provides that any international agreement becomes law within this country when enacted into law by national legislation. But the self-executing provision of an agreement that has been approved by Parliament is law in the Republic unless it is inconsistent with the Constitution or an Act of Parliament. The bill is thus that in response to the Republic's obligation under the CCW as well as under the South African Constitution. And by promulgating the bill, the Republic would have fulfilled its obligations. So when the South African government attends the conference late this year, they will be able to say that they have fulfilled their obligations in terms of giving effect to the protocol itself. So we will not engage in terms of the intentions and the definitions and restrictions. As the committee, we will do that as and when we deliberate on the bill. So today we are going to give opportunity to our stakeholders to raise issues that they want to raise in the bill. And by doing so, I want to welcome Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Williams, such new faces who have worked together before. So we are continuing to do that work. So we will have an opportunity today to make the input, and the committee will consider those reports. Like we did with the earlier bill we dealt with last year, will allow also members to ask questions and engage with the matters that you raise. So I will give Mr. Williams an opportunity from the ICRC to address us for 30 minutes, and then we will have a discussion. And then after that, we will break for tea. So without any waste of time, because we've already lost 20 minutes, I will give to Mr. Williams to address the House, please. If there's any other person who is here, I also see that Mr. Engineer from the department is here. I will want to introduce everybody who is here with us today. I'm not sure who else is here who will be able to acknowledge attendance. I can see also Ms. Maiki, so from the State Legal Advisors is here. I can't see the Parliamentary Legal Advisors. Oh, yes, Mr. Marana, I can see with you. Thank you very much. Without any further ado, let me give over to Mr. Williams to address that. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, honourable members, good morning, and thank you for allowing the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, to address you this morning on certain aspects of your CCW bill. I will use the term that you refer to, CCW, rather than the full title, given it's a fairly cumbersome title. And I'll also refer to international humanitarian law, specifically looking at IHL principles. So if I use the words CCW and IHL, and likewise ICRC, it's more to save time and not to slip with the tongue. With regard to the CCW, my submissions on behalf of the ICRC will be fairly general. We, the ICRC, are in support of this particular bill, having worked with the Department of Defense previously, having been consulted on the matter. And because the CCW, as an instrument of international humanitarian law, is a vital instrument to give further weight to the provisions of international humanitarian law and to the protection therefore. With your permission, Chair, I do know you have received our written submission, so I won't labor in too much detail as to their content. But what I would like to do on behalf of the ICRC is just highlight some of the key IHL principles which the CCW intends to further implement, and give you a little bit more background on CCW and some of the other relevant provisions which you might wish to take into consideration when determining the next step with the bill. For the record, as the Chair noted, South Africa, Republic of South Africa, is presently party to the Framework Convention on the CCW, which is the 1980 convention, plus its first four protocols, which have all been ratified. Only the fifth protocol on explosive remnants of war has yet to be ratified, and I gather there is some discussion within the Department of Defense on such ratification. The CCW is a particularly vital instrument in the eyes of the International Committee of the Red Cross. The International Committee of the Red Cross has been party to discussions and initiated a number of the discussions on the regulation of weapons which cause unnecessary suffering and superfluous injury, and which does not discriminate between civilians and combatants, as early as the 1950s, following the adoption of the 1949 Geneva Conventions, to which South Africa is also party. The ICRC has maintained an interest in the evolving convention and its protocols, and additional protocols which might come to light over the next year or two, which I will touch upon at the end of the presentation. The main area of interest for the ICRC with regard to the CCW bill and the CCW convention and its protocols is the fact that it gives credence to two core underlying IHL principles. The first is that there are limits to war. In other words, the right to the parties to armed conflict to choose the means and methods of warfare is not unlimited. There are clear limits which have been established under international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions of 1949 and the additional protocols, for instance, to which the Republic of South Africa are party. Secondly, the main underlying principle is the fact that weapons which do not discriminate, and by that we're talking about weapons which do not make a distinction between civilians and combatants, are likewise regulated under international humanitarian law. The CCW strives to reinforce those two principles to regulate certain weapons. Going back to generally what IHL is, the basic underlying principles of IHL as a whole, the Geneva Convention, the underlying theme for the international instruments such as the Geneva Conventions and the additional protocols is to limit the suffering caused in times of armed conflict and to regulate the means and methods of warfare. The core instruments of international humanitarian law are the 1949 Geneva Conventions and the additional protocols of 1977. Prior to 1977, there had been two bodies of law known as the Hague Law and the Geneva Law. The Hague Law previously regulated methods of warfare. Since 1977 and with the additional protocols, all issues to do with the means and methods of warfare can be found in the additional protocols. As I mentioned, the Republic of South Africa is party to the protocols as well as to the conventions. There is a third additional protocol which will come to light, which has been ratified as the 2005 additional protocol, which is not relevant to this particular bill, which deals with an additional emblem. If I may, with permission, Chair, just look at some of the sort of aspects of distinction and distinction and what we call CIRUS, the National Committee of the Press called CIRUS. The first principle is that of distinction. International humanitarian law makes it clear, and it has been established now by convention as well as by customary law, that during times of armed conflict, the belligerent parties to the conflict must make a distinction between civilians and combatants, between civilians and combatants and those who are placed hors de combat. In other words, those who are no longer taking part in the hostilities. Those include soldiers who have been wounded, civilians, prisoners of war, and the like. So you have those two clear categories. The concept of distinction is particularly vital with to be considered when it comes down to new weapons. New technological advances have demonstrated that weapons can be much wider in terms of their effects, and a number of the new weapons, which were developed after the Second World War in particular, gave rise to substantial questions into lack of distinction between the ultimate victims as such. So we're looking here, of course, at the example of anti-personnel landmines. It is difficult to direct an anti-personnel landmine towards only military personnel, members of the enemy. anti-personnel landmines do not make a distinction between one victim or another, which is why the Republic of South Africa has fully implemented the Ottawa Treaty, which bans the use of anti-personnel landmines. I think the date is 2001 or 2002. I stand to be corrected. A number of the weapons covered by the CCW fall foul of this violation, of this particular IHL principle in terms of distinction, which is why there's an attempt to try and regulate their use. So without going into great detail, and as the Chair recommended in terms of the nature of the weapons, if I just may touch upon the fact that, for instance, the protocol on incendiary weapons, we're looking here at flamethrowers, napalm, white phosphorus, airborne incendiary weapons, are regulated in one of the protocols in such a manner that civilians cannot be targeted by the use of such weapons, and likewise the military personnel, when planning a strategy and when deciding upon their military objectives, have to take into account the presence of the term is civilian concentration or civilian individuals or civilian objects within that particular area of combat. That is an area of trying to ensure that there is a distinction made between civilians and combatants. Distinction is not only in terms of the locality of the conflict, but also it's a requirement that the parties must take that into consideration. The same is to be attached to the second protocol, which deals with the issue of mines, bombs, and booby traps. As you will see, most of the weapons referred to in the second protocol look at the regulation of those weapons in terms of them making a distinction between civilians and combatants. And I think specifically you should look at the question of booby traps. For military personnel, those that use booby traps, we know they're traps as such, which are usually a form of, whether it's a ruse or perfidious use of certain innocent-looking, I think the list we have here in the convention is looking at carcasses, children's toys, religious books, for instance, and using those to create a booby trap. The question we have here, and this is what this particular protocol is trying to do, is trying to regulate by enforcing the question of saying that these weapons do not discriminate. A booby trap which is placed in a teddy bear, for instance, and this does happen, or placed in an innocent-looking object, does not discriminate between military personnel and between civilians. So if you do go to certain areas of combat where there is still a concentration of civilians, you do run the risk of civilians, children for that instance, picking up innocent-looking objects which ultimately are booby traps. So what the second protocol is trying to do is trying to regulate the conditions in which booby traps, bombs, and lights can be used, and the manner in which mines, especially anti-vehicle mines, can be used. The question of anti-personnel landmines hasn't been dealt with in prior legislation by the government. The second area, which is of particular importance under the CCW, relates to the question of superfluous injury and unnecessary suffering. A term which the ICRC coined a few years ago, we called it the Simon Project. And the ICRC looked into weapons and looked into and tried to assess through medical reports and through the level of injuries and so on, the nature of injuries caused by certain types of weapons, and try to come up with objective standards as to what is deemed to be superfluous injury and what is deemed to be unnecessary suffering. The International Court of Justice, Customs, and most armed forces recognize that the main objective to combat is to weaken the enemy. It is not to prolong suffering and is not to cause unnecessary suffering as such. The weapons which are considered specifically under the CCW and the principles of IHL look at that to say that there are certain types of weapons which go beyond what is necessary for the military to attain its objective in times of combat. The weapons under the CCW specifically are weapons which have been, two of them, are weapons which have been banned because they go beyond what is necessary for the military to attend its objectives. One of the weapons which, without going into technical details, are blinding laser weapons. And what this particular protocol strives to accomplish is to ensure that blinding weapons, i.e. laser weapons which are utilized to, the prime purpose is to blind individuals, unenhanced vision. There's no other purpose to these laser weapons, Chair. They're simply directed usually at the eyes of a combatant, and the resulting damage is permanent blindness. And it was recognized by the majority of states that such weapons go beyond what is necessary doing military combat and doing activities involving belligerent parties to obtain the military goal of winning, let's say, the battle, or winning and weakening the military enemy. Permanent blindness goes beyond what is necessary in that it's irreversible. It's permanent. It's an obvious term. And the question would arise, what happens to the tens or hundreds or thousands of military personnel that have been permanently blinded once the conflict has finished? They go back to the society, and the suffering which has been caused, both psychological and physical, is long-ending until the end of the days as such. The other weapons, which likewise have been regulated, are sort of incendiary weapons, to some extent. So may also look at here also non-detectable fragments. I refer to my notes because it's quite often a mouthful. These are weapons, without going into technicalities, the fragments of which, shrapnel of which, are not detectable by X-ray. And for those of you who have been involved in military combat and who have been exposed to shrapnel, the nature of the injuries is such that once, let's say, for instance, glass or plastic particles enter the body and you have internal bleeding, for instance, if you have to take the wounded soldier into the field hospital as such to be treated, it is very difficult, especially if you have, let's say, in the abdomen, intestinal injuries and so on, and if you cannot use an X-ray to detect where the fragments are lodged, most probably the individual will die as a result. And so the majority of states, about 90 states so far, have signed up to this protocol. The issue being that it prolongs the suffering. The shrapnel in itself has sufficed to take out the enemy from combat, but what the non-detectable fragment is doing is actually creating unnecessary long-term suffering and prolonging the suffering, and ultimately may lead to the death of that particular individual, which goes beyond what is necessary for the military to attain its objectives. Thus goes beyond and falls foul of the grain of these IHL principles. The unnecessary suffering and injury aspects, virus, as well as distinction, are not new concepts. You will find them in the 1977 additional protocols, in particular additional protocol 1, in the preamble to most of the relevant conventions on international humanitarian law. Closer to home, domestically, you have, it has already been regulated by the Republic of South Africa in terms of its constitutional war crime. Under the International Criminal Court Implementation Act of 2002, the government has already regulated and incorporated the provisions of the ICC statute, which is the International Criminal Court based in The Hague, and under Article 8 of that particular statute, by direct reference through your legislation, it is a war crime to use weapons which cause unnecessary suffering and superfluous injury and which do not discriminate. Another reference closer to home, likewise, is the TRC, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, in its report in the second volume, underscores these principles, indicating our quotes in volume 2, pages 52 to 55. IHL stipulates that the right of parties in a conflict to adopt means of injuring the enemy is not unlimited, and that a distinction must at all times be made between persons taking part in hostilities and civilians, with the latter being spared as much as possible. This is looking specifically at the question of the limits to the rights of parties in times of armed conflict, but also to the concept of distinction. In addition, and I haven't seen the up-to-date one, but in the 1996 Law of Armed Conflict Manual of South African Defence Forces, there's likewise a reference to the questions of superfluous injury and these types of weapons. Again, to quote, a basic principle of the Law of Armed Conflict, which is also IHL, which is the usual term for IHL, is the prevention of unnecessary suffering. The test in relation to a particular weapon is whether suffering occasioned by its use is needless, superfluous, or grossly disproportionate to the advantage gained. Weapons which are calculated to cause unnecessary suffering are illegal per se. Such weapons include barbed spears, dum-dum bullets, weapons filled with glass, and weapons that inflame wounds. Number two, legal weapons may not be used in a manner which cause unnecessary suffering. So again, in the training manual of the South African National Defence Forces, there is a reference there to the questions of these principles, distinction, and unnecessary suffering. And the International Court of Justice has likewise reaffirmed these basic rules as inviolable rules of international humanitarian law and a fundamental rule to be observed by all states. and it's a reference to the opinion on the use of nuclear weapons. There have been a number of questions looking specifically at weapons with the time I have remaining, chair, to allow for questions. By regulating these weapons, are military personnel placed at a disadvantage? The question would be, is there any advantage in using the weapons in a manner which goes against the CCW and it goes against IHL? The regulations under protocol, especially Protocol 2 on the mines, booby traps and other devices, and under Protocol 3 on the incendiary weapons, are placed in the restrictions. Is there an advantage to be gained in using incendiary weapons against a civilian population? Is there a military advantage to be gained in not planning one strategy and taking out the enemy without any consideration taken for the presence of civilians in the zone of combat? That is a question that military can answer, but it has been generally agreed by the vast majority of states and by the states, including the Republic of South Africa, signed up to this convention and to the additional protocols and the Geneva Conventions, that no, there is no military advantage as such to taking out using such weapons against civilian objectives or to put the civilian population at risk. The issue of non-detectable fragments and outright prohibition on those, is there a military advantage to be gained by wounding a soldier and making it impossible to treat that soldier once it's taken off the field of combat? It's a question I'll leave hanging, but the aim is to take the soldier out of combat. Once the soldier has been taken out of combat, there is no further military advantage which can be gained from creating unnecessary suffering and allowing a soldier in the field hospital, for instance, not to be treated appropriately because the fragments are not detectable. And last but not least, the laser weapons and the blinding laser weapons, it could be argued that there is an advantage to blinding the enemy. However, without going into the other types of weaponry available, if it is a temporary blindness or a dazzle as such, and there is substantial laser weaponry available in such regards, that is not banned as such under international humanitarian law. If it is a temporary blindness, CCW does not cover such weapons. So there might be a military advantage in gaining the advantage by blinding your enemy for, let's say, a few minutes or a few hours, but can the same be said for blinding your enemy on a permanent basis? Irrespective of whether or not there is an advantage to be gained or not, the fact is that the use of such weapons these days, and in particular given that the Republic of South Africa has adopted the ICC statute and given it full implementation, means that you would be in violation of your requirements under international humanitarian law, and soldiers or military personnel or commanders who direct the use of such weapons could be held responsible under the ICC statute, whether domestically or before the International Criminal Court. Touching upon, before turning to a couple of the specific comments on the bill that I have, in terms of South Africa's commitment to the principles of international humanitarian law. And those, without a doubt, the Republic of South Africa is fully committed to ensuring full implementation and domestication and respect of international humanitarian law. Without going down the full list, the fact is that South Africa has signed up and fully domesticated Convention on Chemical Weapons Convention, Biological Weapons Convention, Ottawa Anti-Personnel Landmines Convention, 1997. You are party to the Geneva Conventions of 1949 as well as the additional protocols, and I gather the Department of Defense is working on a bill in that regard. You have signed up to the International Criminal Court Statute, and you have taken a very active role in the meeting of government experts and the state parties of the CCW. The last meeting being in November 2006 during the third review conference, where the final declaration, consensus declaration, to which all state parties, including Republic of South Africa, signed up to, underscores the importance of implementation and respect of CCW, of its compliance, of the need to adopt necessary legislation, domestic legislation, give full effect to the CCW provisions. The need to adopt penal offences and to create penal offences and to create penal sanctions in domestic legislation. So for the most part, and for just about all of these core international humanitarian law conventions, especially with weapons and means and methods of weapons, the Republic of South Africa has already shown its commitment in that regard. Questions had also been raised about the possibility during peacekeeping operations of, let's say the enemy uses such weapons, why should we not be in a position to use such weapons? The fact is, if troops are involved in UN peacekeeping missions under UN Chapter 7, for instance, peacekeeping missions, such troops will not be allowed or entitled to use any of the weapons covered by CCW and are bound as troops of the United Nations or serving under the flag of the United Nations to respect international humanitarian law and thereby respect the core principles of distinction between civilians and combatants and likewise the core principles of unnecessary suffering and superfluous injury are not to be committed during times of conflict. So to serve as a peacekeeping troop likewise, South African troops and troops for any other country that, for that matter, would be bound by the UN basic principles. This being the CCW being a UN convention to sort of reinforce the point. Those are just some of the general points to indicate that on behalf of the IPRC, we're very supportive of the Republic of South Africa's attempt to legislate fully for the CCW, the fact that, that South Africa is party to the CCW. There are two or three minor comments which we have suggested in terms of specific comments. Those are in the written submissions. Two of those are of no apparent substance. One is just adding a word laser in your definition of blinding laser weapon, but I don't need to, unless the chair wishes me to explain in more detail the reason for such an assertion. And the other is to remove the definition eventually of explosive ordnance or unexploded ordnance, as these terms do not seem to appear in the bill. So those are two comments which are not of great substance. One which has potential substance, but is to do with Section 10 on the surrender of prohibited weapons and forfeiture to state. The suggestion there for your consideration, honourable members of the committee, is to consider whether or not you wish to give more power to, for instance, the police or to those authorities which have been identified in that particular section, for over to whom the weapons are meant to be handed, to see whether or not they could be more proactive and undertake search and seizure. You have similar clauses already in the Gathering Anti-Personnel Act, and likewise to do with chemical weapons and biological weapons, where representatives of the state, let's say the South African police, military police, have more power than just being on the receiving end. They can actually take steps if there is a suspicion or reasonable grounds, depending on the standard that you apply, to actually search a seizure with a warrant, premises, dwelling homes, and so on, where there might be such illegal weapons. So that's just for your consideration to see whether or not you wish to give more power as such to the relevant officials. In conclusion, Madam Chair, so I refer to the written submissions and remain available for any further sort of clarification on some of the points. It needs only be said that the work on the CCW is important work. It is an ongoing process. The Framework Convention from 1980 was merely a framework convention. And it's a proactive convention in that it has left it open-ended to adopt new protocols if need be, as and when new weapons are, let's say, used or invented, which may fall foul of these ISO provisions. You are at present, Representative Salak is at present party to the four protocols. There is work on possible ratification of the fifth protocol on explosive remnants of war. Of course, you may wish to take that into consideration if ratification were to come about before the adoption of this bill, to actually have an insert of a reference to that protocol and maybe one article on that protocol in terms of regulations for the cleanup and marking of explosive remnants of war. The last two points, which are small points, which you may wish to take into account, South Africa has been party to a process which was initiated last year by a number of states during the review conference on CCW to regulate the use of cluster munitions. Cluster munitions do not figure in this bill as such, but it's just an area, again, where you have shown your commitment to respecting the principles of international humanitarian law and are at the forefront of the discussions on regulations of certain weapons which might go against IHL. Secondly, and lastly, Madam Chair, it should be noted that the first specific reference to means and methods of warfare under the Geneva Convention and the Additional Protocols came about in 1977, in Additional Protocol 1 specifically. The government, the Republic of South Africa, is party to those protocols. This year, we're marking a particularly important anniversary, the 30th anniversary of the adoption of those protocols. So any action taken in that regard is particularly important given that we're 30 years down the line. To date, the Geneva Conventions have been ratified by all states. They have been universally ratified. The additional protocols are not far from there. We're looking around the 160, 170 mark, but the numbers change. And likewise, the CCW, a majority of states have signed up to the CCW and the protocols. The figures are changing, but the CCW have about 100 states party to the main framework convention and approximately 90 for each of the protocols, which is a, excuse me, a very strong message to the respective international humanitarian law by having so many state parties on board. It has also been argued in a number of circles that many of the aspects dealing with these weapons are deemed customary in nature, so go beyond convention. And last but not least, it should also be noted that among the state parties of the CCW, all prominent members of the Security Council have signed up to the Framework Convention and to the majority of the protocols. With that, Madam Chair, I will conclude my presentation of my orders of my written submissions in an oral manner. Chair.
Thank you very much. But you did not mention how many countries have legislated. That is okay. Honourable Member, you have an opportunity to interact with the presentation. Thank you very much for sharply sticking to your 30 minutes presentation. Can I have an indication, Honourable Munari?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, Mr. Williams. When I go through your presentation, I realize that you are actually supporting the intentions of our government to introduce the CCW in South Africa and legislate it. So that for me is good. And when you raised a number of issues, I don't think there were a lot of contradictory issues in as far as the bill is concerned. So for me, I think it is, I feel confident that we are actually on the right track and the right path. And just ask you a few, you know, questions around, you see, the issue of temporary blinding of the enemy. You know, I know that for civilian purposes, when you want to prevent an assailant from attacking another civilian, you can use a weapon which may semi-blind you or semi-destabilize you, such that you are able to apprehend the assailant. But that is at civilian level. Then with a military situation, it's difficult where as soon as you go into a military environment, and at the same time you get in your heart a consideration that I don't want to effect superfluous injury. So you know when you get into a war, everything is different. You act such that you defeat the enemy. And the only way of defeating the enemy is making sure that even the issue of injuring the enemy is unquestionable. The enemy has to be annihilated. So I'm just saying, inasmuch as there are international protocols and conventions to regulate conflict and war situations, in real and practical terms, we have a clear example anywhere in the world where we can say this is happening, that you can prohibit or you can restrict a vicious attack on the enemy. So I'm just saying these are the issues which, in as much as you appreciate that we have to make interventions, but at the end of the day we have to be realistic and practical. So that's one point I wanted to use. The second point is that obviously in implementation or in making sure that it is what is built is effected correctly. The authorities responsible who suggest that they should be given more power. I know that we do have the National Convention on Arms Control Committee, which is responsible for making sure that it affects appropriately whatever convention which has to do with conventional weapons. So I'm sure that we have that. So even if you give the police, obviously, legally, police have a legal authority and jurisdiction to make sure that they implement or effect on violation of any law. So obviously the police can deal with it. The defense, intelligence, and many such bodies which are responsible for making sure that laws and legislation is not violated. So I'm saying sometimes it's unquestionable to come up with structure unless you say the NCACC in its form and nature has no capacity to implement whatever. So I'm not saying that's the point you raised that I want you to actually assist me. Then the third point is on the, you see, when you deal with the definition, I don't see the difference in the bills and the insertion you want to make on the blinding laser weapon, because it's laser. But laser is there in the actual bill. Laser is there. So I want you to give me clarification around that. Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Gordon.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation, and it's very clear-cut. I'm also happy to see in the bill that you've been extensively consulted or consistently consulted in drafting of the bill, so I think most of your comments have already been drafted into the bill, the ICRC. Just a question on the compliance mechanism. This was done in December last year, the third review conference. I just want to make sure that your considered opinion, how effectively will this compliance mechanism be for the contracting parties to consult each other and to cooperate with each other bilaterally? And in that sense, if you look at the 102 state parties who signed the convention or who ratified it, there's a number of countries who either had reservations or made declarations. And some of the countries are major countries in the world. I just want to ask your opinion. If we look at the compliance mechanism for state parties to cooperate and to consult one another, at the same time, you have parties who ratify the convention, but say, I have reservation on clause A, B, C. And thirdly, how do you relate that to the vision for all state parties, hopefully, to legislate eventually? That is my first part in your informed opinion. Secondly, you talked about the new technology and new weapons. How can you advise this committee? How do you regulate or legislate for new weapons, new technology? Do you create enabling legislation? Do you amend it, in your opinion, from the ICRC? And then I did not quite hear or understand whether you have an opinion of whether Protocol 5 should be part of this convention. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Diale.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also will comment on the presentation. Madam Chair, mine is a question. Firstly, I would like to say that we are living in the world of conflicts of war.
Now, it is of course important to regulate the certain dangerous weapons which can make, you know, civilians to be crippled or blind. But at the same time, since we are living in the world of conflict of wars, I think we should be careful in restricting this weapon. I'm saying this because the superpowers, like for instance the USA, I'm going to ask them that question. We don't know whether the US has signed this convention. US, as we all are aware, that it violates the United Nations and go to conquer a certain country in the name of chemical weapons and such. We don't know whether at any time too, if we differ with certain points with the United States, might attack one of our countries in Africa or ourselves. Now, Honorable Naring has mentioned the fact that at war, what is important in the war is to defeat the enemy. It's not negotiations. Negotiations come first, and last resort is a war. During that war, you have to defeat that enemy. No other way. But to defeat that enemy, see, you are not sophisticated like that enemy, but must make means to defeat that enemy, which is attacking you. We have in the US, in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yugoslavia, and so on and so on and so on. We don't know how far is the US going to in violating the United Nations, where all the states have signed this convention. Now, Madam Chair, this was my comment. Now, I would like the presenter to answer whether the U.S. has signed this convention. I'm worried about the U.S. I think all of us were worried about the U.S. What U.S. does in the world today. Now, I want to know whether the U.S. is right. Looking at the media, for instance, yesterday, 190,000 of weapons are stolen in what do you call it, not Iraq, Afghanistan, for instance. I don't know whether it's true, but I was looking at the media, 190,000 is stolen. We don't know what kind of those weapons. And we don't know who has captured them and where are they going to be used. So this is my comment. But restrictions, I agree, but let us not disarm our forces such that when the war comes, we'll be defeated. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other comments, members? In the instance of
I forgot to just follow up question, which is what I asked, to say that how much does this convention and protocols inhibit for the country's capacity to defend itself in an event of an imminent war situation. Because you see that part is fine. The question is just asked. And at the same time, we know that obviously the intention is making sure that we want to avoid a war as much as possible. We want to avoid confrontation as much as possible. But what I observe is that the technology is advancing, and countries are actually getting creative in terms of getting into new technology. So in as much as you want to prohibit and restrict, how do you preserve what you call your other intellectual properties or your patent rights, in making sure that you are prepared and ready for a worse situation?
Thank you, Honorable Daniel. Those members who have spoken before, I think we can have a second round of discussion. Can we allow Honorable Daniel?
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I understand what it is that I'm trying to do and what is the International Committee of Red Cross is saying. But my concern is, let's put more on emphasis on trying to stop civilians to be hurt rather than dealing with the after effects of war. Mine would be, what has the International Committee of Red Cross done in trying to see to it with all these CCW weapons are being used worldwide? What has it done to see to it they are not being used? Thank you.
Thank you. On the basis of the substantive issues you raised in your comments. One is on the rules of engagement world over. How people who, whether it's from the rebel forces or from professional armies, how people not necessarily adhere to the rules of engagement. We know, and a lot of examples that we can make, Afghanistan, we can raise issues around Afghanistan, we can raise issues around Iran itself. There is an Israel, the type of weapons that Israel used in relation to the Palestinians. I think there was an outcry, a world outcry. But my interest is more on the issue of peacekeeping missions, where we all know that rebels, for instance, the gender witch, do you believe that the gender witch will adhere to any protocol of United Nations? We need to have a comment to clarify ourselves that when the United Nations or the African Union send peacekeepers to a mission, and they are met with actions of gender witch that might have a certain impact or that will relate to the CCW weapons, what becomes? Do we say, when it happens, then we have 1,000 South African troops coming home and they are blind, they're semi-paralyzed? As we're talking now to the Darfur region, I have that 26,000 troops will be sent. Of course, the United Nations has confirmed that. In an event that that happens, and it's not mentioned in the protocol, it's not mentioned in the articles that are about to be ratified, whether it's Article 4 or Article 5, it's not made mention thereof. In terms of adherence to the rules of engagement, how then do we regulate as a country? I was interested to hear you make such a comment in that regard. Two, it's on the issue of which you were neither here or there. It's the delegation of powers, as mentioned in the draft, to give it to the Inspector General, Brigadier General in this case. You had a comment that whether do we want to give all those powers to that individual. But in the bill, we cannot leave the bill ambiguous or open-ended. We'll have to give specific responsibility. So did you have a suggestion as to how then, because process itself clarifies the role of that individual, but have you had any impression that is that not adequate? You will need to have a different individual taking responsibility thereof. The other issue, it was the issue of the declaration, which has been partly covered by the corridor. If you remember, different countries since 1980 today have made different declarations. Of course, in terms of their own interests of the security industries, we know that those countries that have made different declarations. How do we see the impact of those declarations based on the machine program? We are about to hear. We want to hear your comments. Thank you.
Madam Chair, honourable members, quite a few questions. I'll try and regroup them into sort of two categories. The first category being the category looking at specific comments to the bill, and the other in terms of the more, I think, policy and general comments in terms of the ideas of conflict and the nature of the convention. With regard to the definition of blinding weapons, we're looking from the copy, the version of the bill I have, which was sent to us, I think it was in November or December last year. The definition at this stage reads, blinding laser weapon means a weapon specifically designed as its sole combat function as one of its combat functions to cause permanent blindness to the naked eye. The recommendation here will be more specific in the body of the definition itself, so that blinding laser weapon means a laser weapon, because we're looking here specifically at laser weapons. So it'll just be an insert of the word laser in that part of the definition. And my apologies if there was no clarity in the submission. The issue of oversight body of who may be the body responsible, and I think it's sort of a number of questions we joined that particular concern. The ICRC does not have a specific position in that regard as to which body and how individual states go about regulating compliance with the CCW. Unlike other conventions that I can cite here, for instance, the 1993 Chemical Weapons Convention, where there was a clear oversight mechanism put in place with the creation of a United Nations body, OPCW, based in The Hague, one of the weaknesses, which was alluded to by a number of the critics of the CCW, was that there is no clear, strong oversight body as such to ensure compliance. There is, of course, through the UN Secretariat, between the various member states. And here we're looking at specifically at a domestic level. For biological weapons, for chemical weapons, you have a body in place already which looks into this, which has the speciality and necessary expertise to actually decipher what is a chemical weapon, what are the various formula, what is a chemical weapon component, what potentially could be a carrier for chemical weapons, etc., and to monitor the trade, import, export, borders, control facilities, factories, etc. The CCW does not have that. So the suggestion, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, neither here nor there, is very much for the committee to consider to what extent and what body would be the best body as such and the best equipped body to ensure compliance with this particular convention, specifically because this convention deals with weapons. So it may have to be a committee with expertise in the weapons trade, weapons industry, weapons transfer, and so on, and likewise with some expertise in international humanitarian law and principles. So this is a suggestion to consider as to what kind of body. Whether it's the police, the NCACC, or any other body, very much depends on your process and the policy decision in that regard. And the recommendation in terms of giving more powers to the police was in line with with the bill at this stage, to say that at this stage the onus is on the possessor of the weapons to inform the relevant body, and I think here it is the police, of possession of such weapons, and then to hand them over within a certain amount of time. What one is suggesting might be a stronger compliance mechanism was to have a body in place which can actually take the initiative and say, we know that X, Y, Z possesses those weapons and is not handing them over to us or has not informed us of their possession, and to somehow allow for more powers in that regard to that body, whichever that body may be, or to those officials, whomever those officials may be, to actually take the initiative and to ask and to search and to seize, if necessary, the facilities, or to serve warrants on the relevant individuals or companies. So I don't have, the ICC does not have a specific suggestion, just to say there is a need, one would have thought, to have a recognized body with a strong compliance mechanisms in place to allow for the initiative to be taken by that particular body. A specific comment in terms of...
Sorry, Mr. William, before you proceed, sorry if I pronounce the same wrong, Mr. Jela. I think you might want to say something on this place. As the doctor, specifically on the issue of delegation of powers.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm Jata. Chairperson, on the question of delegation of powers, all that we're saying in the legislation is that, or in the draft deal, is that the Minister of Defence has the responsibility. However, the Minister would not be at all material times in a position to execute that. And therefore, he must delegate those powers to specific individuals. He starts by doing so to the Secretary for Defense, the DG of the Department, and the Chief. And obviously, then, in terms of line command, that will be rolled down right up to the point of a Director or a Brigadier General. But that delegation of powers does not, therefore, take away the accountability of the Minister of Defense in terms of accounting for that responsibility. It's just for convenience of execution that it can be delegated, but it remains with the ultimate responsibility of accounting. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I wanted that intervention in an event that people see that you need to give this responsibility to a different body. Will it help when we're dealing with the police to engage whether do we need to have a body separate from the Department of Defense, or whether should the department, I think members will know that issue. I just wanted further clarification as to at which point did we come to this issue of the transit process. Thank you very much. You may proceed, Mr. William.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The two other, I think, specific questions, the first linked to the question of Protocol 5. And the Protocol 5 to the entered into force in, I think it was December last year, there are about 30 state parties to date, and Protocol 5 deals with explosive remnants of war. In other words, the cleanup operations, the marking, the dropping of particular bombs, for instance, cluster munitions, and what happens post-conflict to the remains, to unexploded ordnance in zones of conflict. You have situations in various conflicts in the former Yugoslavia, for instance, years back, where you'd come out of a church or a school and walk down the street, and there'd be a sign warning of landmines or unexploded ordnance. For those of us who have been educated in the relevant signs and know what to look out for, that's one thing. For children, for instance, who have no idea, they will run across those particular fields and pick up whatever they may see, a shiny object or something which is round, which may be used as a football, which actually turns out to be unexploded ordnance. It's unfortunate, but it's an unfortunate reality, and a sad reality of modern-day warfare and the leftovers, the mess. And we've seen it in a number of countries, which is why there was a big move to have the issue of the Ottawa landmine process was taken on board, because CCW was seen as not strong enough, specifically for anti-personnel landmines. And the Republic of South Africa was one of the first countries on board that particular process. Landmines, you can go to countries within the region and all over the world, are still affected by landmines. And tens of thousands, if not millions of landmines, unexploded landmines, which end up in fields, for instance, and farmers plowing their fields, and before they know it, they step across a landmine. And most casualties these days from landmines are in post-conflict societies. And most of the individuals wounded as a result of landmines are civilians. But what the Protocol 5 attempts to do is to put in place regulations and mechanisms whereby states using such weapons have a responsibility to clean up after they've used such weapons. You make a mess, you clean up the mess as such, if I may use the more vulgar language in that regard. And the aim here, of course, is to ensure that once the conflict has finished, the society can be rehabilitated and can go back to a normal society as such, post-conflict, and to allow for reconstruction and so on and so forth. So Protocol 5, I believe there was discussion within the Department of Defense, within the government, to actually ratify that particular protocol. At this stage, and I stand to be corrected, the process is underway. But of course, it's a matter of time, and that's the policy decision as to whether or not you ratify this matter, this particular protocol. It may not need to have specific reference within this particular bill. However, if it seems to be fairly clear-cut that this particular protocol may be ratified, then there may be a need to have, at least at this stage, depending on how long the process with the bill would take, to have initial reference or even open-ended reference within the bill to additional protocols coming into effect. What is interesting with this particular Protocol 5 is that most of it deals with regulations and training and manuals. So there is no real need to have, and I think we would recommend against there being extensive clauses in the bill dealing with Protocol 5. It could be simply either by way of reference or by having a couple of lines in a single article referring to the protection of civilians and to clean up operations, and to the minister having the power to issue the necessary regulations in that regard. So again, it depends on how far the ratification process is advancing, whether or not Republic of South Africa decides to ratify that particular protocol. And there's a possibility to just, if you so wish, a catch-all, to leave it open for further protocols to come into effect if a need, if and when the need arises. But again, that depends on the policy decision in that regard. With regard to the regulation on new weapons, exactly, that's one of the interesting aspects of warfare and production of weapons, is that individuals and companies are able to develop weapons which do create quite interesting damage and certain injuries which one would never have thought of. And that is one of the main bones of contention for international humanitarian law, for the ICRC, for United Nations bodies and for governments, is to regulate on such manner. Additional Protocol 1, to which, of the Geneva Conventions, to which the Republic of South Korea's party has specific reference in there to legal review of new means and methods of warfare and new weapons as such. There was a meeting of experts last year hosted by the ICRC to look into the various types of mechanisms put in place by various countries in terms of how do they implement that particular article, how do they review the legality of new weapons. What is a legal weapon? What is an illegal weapon? What kind of injury is superfluous? What kind of injuries are necessary, etc.? We do have the ICRC, we do have records of that, and it's a public document, so I can make them available to the committee on my return to the office in the next few days. So at least you have the report and you can see what other countries have been doing in terms of reviewing the legality of new weapons and what kind of bodies. And again, I'll stand corrected, I gather there were representatives from the Department of Defense at that particular meeting last year. But I'll make the documents available, Madam Chair, with your permission. The, if I may say, the looking at the more general questions, the one in terms of the civilians being hurt, since that one, I gather all the others are sort of more linked to the reality of the warfare. With the issue of civilians being hurt, that is the very essence of international humanitarian law. And that is the very essence of the 14th Geneva Convention in 1949. The fact is, modern day warfare sees a much ever increasing number of fatalities in the civilian population. It's warfare prior to the First World War. One could look at the table and see that the forces in the very traditional and archaic forms of warfare would face off as such across opposing hills and have head-on battle as such, I may use those terms. With modern technology, more often than not, the military personnel are kept away from the line, from the front of facilities and from the zone of facilities, and civilians find themselves usually caught in the midst of conflict, which is why the ICRC, since 1863, has been working with governments to ensure that civilians are protected, to ensure that the troops are aware of the necessary ISO principles. And this work that the ICRC has been undertaking with governments, with NGOs, with military, is wide-ranging. So it goes from, for instance, this particular level we're at here now, in terms of legislation, in terms of adopting necessary laws, creating war crimes, creating to the lower level, which is working directly with members of the armed forces, with SANDF. We have very strong relationships with SANDF in terms of training, training new cadets, training officers in the law of armed conflict, having certain modules and having a continuous presence and dialogue with members of the armed forces for training in that regard, so they know what is permitted and what is not permitted in times of armed conflict. And it goes beyond that, likewise, in terms of quasi-lobbying, working with the United Nations and other international organizations, the African Union and so on, to ensure that international humanitarian law and the principles are put into place. And last but not least, the ICRC is highly involved in zones of armed conflict. Unlike a number of organizations, when conflict arises, the ICRC is usually the first one there. Because the ICRC has been given a specific mandate by state parties to the Geneva Conventions, which includes the Republic of South Africa, to ensure that international humanitarian law is respected. That includes protection of civilians, and in particular protection of civilians. The ICRC will be in zones of conflict, and the ICRC is present in every single zone of armed conflict to ensure that the rules are respected. And that is through dialogue. So the ICRC will meet with the belligerents on one side or the other side, whether it's a small rebel group in the middle of nowhere, or whether it's with a formidable superpower, the ICRC has a constant dialogue and will talk on a confidential basis with those individuals to ensure that they know what the norms are. And if there are violations of international humanitarian law, we'll raise it directly with the parties to ensure that those violations are an end is put to those violations, and Aisha is respected. So it's a continuous and it's ongoing process. But you can rest assured, honourable member, that the ICRC is fully involved and fully committed to ensuring the protection of civilians in times of armed conflict, which is the very core of international humanitarian law. There's one more specific question in terms of the United States of America and whether or not they have signed up to CCW. From the information we do have from the United Nations and the depository, all the program members of the Security Council have signed up to the CCW. The United States is amongst those, has signed up to the CCW and to at least two, if not three, of their protocols. So they are state party. And still looking at the issue of reservations and declarations, Madam Chair, that is the unfortunate reality of international law. That's the unfortunate reality of international law when it's dealing with issues of weapons. There are always bags of interest and various interests when we're looking at weapons industries, when we're looking at the regulation of weapons, and when we're looking at military necessity, military strategies, and what a military should be entitled to use in times of armed conflict. The fact is that the CCW is in itself successful by even having such a convention on board in the 1980s, by now having five protocols and an ongoing process to do with cluster munitions. They will, in terms of the actual impact of ratification and declarations, if we were to go through the list of reservation declarations, I might be able to be more specific, but not having those before me, it's difficult to say what impact they would have. But however, it is the reality of modern-day international law that there will be such reservations, and it is for the majority of states to try and overcome those reservations and declarations and to underscore the viability of these IHL principles and to ensure that the convention is respected. State parties by signing up to these treaties likewise are ensuring that they do respect these conventions. The more general question...
Specific cases that we can refer to where protocols are not necessarily respected. I think, we need to acknowledge that.
Like Madam Chair, the distinction there would be where you have, if you have a lack of respect of a protocol to which you're state party, then you're in violation of that particular protocol. At this present stage, if you're in violation of that protocol, the state party could be brought to account before, let's say, for instance, the Security Council, but if there's a violation of use of such weapons, the ICC, the International Criminal Court, or the Security Council deemed the violation to be sufficiently serious, then it could be referred to the International Criminal Court. Even if that particular state is not a state party to the International Criminal Court, and we know certain countries are not state parties to that particular court. So in terms of adherence, likewise, that is more in the realm of whether it's international justice or in the realm of international relations and geopolitics in terms of how do we ensure the adherence. The more sort of generalized question in terms of are the weapons covered by the CCW going to in any way minimize our capability in times of armed conflict. We need to defeat the enemy. There might be rebel forces using such weapons, the Xinjiang Weed, for instance. The realities of conflict are fairly murky, to say the least. What international humanitarian law tries to do is stay away from the reasons for a conflict being in existence. International humanitarian law comes into existence when there is conflict. Use in middle, use in the Latin terms. We don't, when we try to apply international humanitarian law, look at the reasons for conflict. To do so would minimize any efficiency we might have in ensuring the respect for international humanitarian law. As to why one country or another country may go into another country and start a conflict is an aspect which deals with another area of international law, which is not international humanitarian law as such. If we were to start debating that when we try to apply international humanitarian law, you would lose the weight which international humanitarian law is trying to attach to itself during times of armed conflict. And yes, there might be situations in times of armed conflict when the various groups are using certain weapons, and that's the unfortunate reality of conflict. Certain groups see anti-personnel landmines as a weapon of the poor. And it's easier to buy anti-personnel landmines than to buy normal weapons, weapons which are justifiable in times of armed conflict. That's the reality of conflict. And that's something which we're trying and striving by having the majority of states on board with the CCW and international humanitarian law instruments in general, and the Geneva Convention for that matter, to ensure that such instances will be limited. Looking specifically at, for instance, whether a particular rebel group might have and possess the technology to have blinding laser weapons, that's highly unlikely because the technology is in the hands of very few countries. The issue there is more in terms of ensuring that the P5 and those who do develop such weapons have already signed up to the convention and certain of the protocols. If there is a violation, if certain groups are using those weapons, let's say against peacekeepers, then again, that is a reality of conflict. But it does not justify the peacekeepers, and they're not entitled to use those weapons. So there may be an ill against the peacekeepers, but the peacekeepers are not entitled or allowed to use the same weapons back as sort of a reprisal, or using, okay, you've used these weapons, we'll use the same against you, under international humanitarian law, under the United Nations Charter. So what we have to do here, through peacekeepers, we're having a majority of states, and here we're looking at over 100 states, and the numbers increasing, is to ensure that those situations and instances are limited, to ensure that individuals know that even if you do believe that a certain weapon might be more advantageous in terms of use in times of armed conflict, the fact is that basic international humanitarian law principles prohibit the use of such weapons. Likewise, if certain groups decide to use incendiary weapons within confrontations with civilians, does one gain a military advantage by using the same weapons back within the civilian population? No, it's in violation of international humanitarian law. To defeat the enemy, there are countless of strategies available. There are no doubt hundreds of weapons available to military personnel to defeat the enemy. Permanent blindness goes beyond defeating the enemy. It creates unnecessary suffering and superfluous injury. Other weapons are available. Other strategies are available. Many argue that by respecting international humanitarian law, by limiting oneself as the conventions are requesting states to state powers to limit themselves, you have a much greater chance of having peaceful, harmonious relations developing between the belligerents post-conflict than if you were to use weapons which are prohibited under CCW. I'll only come back to the question. Practical terms, yes, one may argue it's better to use such weapons, but with the vast majority of states being on board at this stage, practically the vast majority of states have agreed it is not best to use those weapons. It is better to prohibit those weapons because even war has its limits. It's as simple as that. But again, it's the reality of modern-day conflicts that there will always be development of new weapons, which is why states, such republics that are taken and showing such a commitment in regulating this particular industry when weapons are used in times of armed conflict. And if I may say exactly, coming back to the distinction sometimes, that in times of peace one may use certain products that we cannot use in times of armed conflict. Again, there are some nuances, and I look here, for instance, the Chemical Weapons Convention, where riot control agents are, and here we're looking at the product rather than the individual, the products can be used by the police as a riot control agent. The same cannot be used by military personnel in times of combat. That's the reality of international humanitarian law and the reality of armed conflict. Looking through this, I gather I've regrouped most answers.
That's a whole affair because it's long past the time for tea break, just to get members to refresh and come back. Because we still have, but we do it at least in 7 minutes. Yeah, we can quickly have tea and we come back and we continue from there. Thank you.
And it has Thank you.
Honorable members, we are reconvening. We had an ample chance to have our refreshment. I will start by giving Mr. Williams a chance to continue from where he left, because I had to cut him short from tea break. Then we continue with the questions, and we must be careful at the questions we want to pose, as we are running short of time. But because the ceasefire campaign has not yet reported to them, so we do have more time, because we are scheduled to finish by 4. Oh, thank you. Yeah, I know. So we just have your name there. Then since we don't have the time with us, we have because we are here. So let's continue. Let's do it. Last one, last 10, 15 minutes. Till the next. Thank you.
Madam Chair, thank you. I was just about finished in summing up. I think I may have covered, I hope I've covered all the questions that the honourable members put to the ICRC. There was one question put to the Chair, put by the Chair regarding the use of certain weapons last year. That particular conflict was the Lebanon conflict between Israel and Lebanon in, I think it was June, July last year. And the alleged use of, or the extensive alleged use by one of the belligerents of cluster munitions. And the fact that over the last 40 hours of the conflict there, I think thousands of cluster munitions were, for those of you who are not familiar with cluster munitions, I think in very layman's terms, you have a mother bomb as such, which opens up, and then within that mother bomb you have maybe 10, 20, 30, 40, a couple of hundred baby bombnets within. And the difficulty with cluster munitions, and many of the issues raised by the experts is that, one, the area of coverage can be quite extensive, especially where some of them are carried by wind. I gather some of you may have little parachutes at the back of them. And there's also a percentage of those which do not explode. So once they have landed, they remain where they are, and they might ultimately become, they are an unexploded ordnance of war, and they might ultimately become a threat, an issue, and a danger to the civilian population post-conflict. And I think that's what the situation has been, and I think the UN reports on it, is that in certain areas of Lebanon, there's effectively a no-man's land because you have leftover cluster munitions within olive groves and farmland, etc. So there is a process which was initiated and discussed at the last review conference, and it's called the Oslo process, which is looking to regulate and to come up with some, whether it's a separate convention or whether it's an additional protocol to the CCW, to regulate the use of cluster munitions. And the process is very much in its infancy stage, and there's two or three positions. Some called for an outright ban on the use of cluster munitions. Others called for a restriction on the use of cluster munitions. The ICRC has called for a restriction on cluster munitions in zones where you have civilian concentrations or presence of civilians. And other groups have called for allowing the use of cluster munitions, but ensuring that there's some fail-safe and some safeguards on those cluster munitions so that they will, whether they detonate or whether or not they will, neutralize themselves after a certain period of time, whether it's a month or 2 weeks or so on. So you have different positions have been presented at this stage, and the process is ongoing. And again, Gather Republic of South Africa has been party to this process as well, and it's very much in its infancy, but I think there's about 30 or so countries on board at this stage looking at the question of cluster munitions. And Chair, just to wrap up, because I know you're pressed for time, it is true that this particular bill throws up quite a few questions in terms of practicalities for the military, what it means in terms of impact, in terms of defending oneself, etc. But I think one has to look beyond that and to recognize what the CCW is doing is merely reinforcing what are pre-existing IHL principles and pre-existing IHL obligations for the Republic of South Africa. And IHL principles to which the Republic of South Africa and the majority of states around the world subscribe to, which is there are limits to war, there are limits to the types of weapons that can be used, and weapons which go beyond what is necessary to the military to attempt objective need to be regulated or need to be prohibited in certain circumstances. And last but not least, you have to at all times make a distinction between civilians and combatants when using certain weapons, which is the part and parcel of about half of this particular Convention 2 with protocols, which is to separate and to ensure that if you're going to use a particular weapon, you are not putting the civilian population or civilian objects at risk by the use of such weapons, because such weapons just don't discriminate as such. Madam Chair, in those minutes, I think that's all I have to say unless you have more questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member. I have an indication of Dr. Kurenhoff and Honourable Nara. Are you covered? Covered. Thank you very much. We'll thank Mr. Williams for the substantive inputs you have made. We have noted your comments. I think the committee will consider that in terms of the amendments, both in terms of definition and substantive issues. You are welcome to attend all our meetings, and I know that you are about to catch a flight, so you are released. Thank you very much for the input. Now I'll take this opportunity to give Mr. Simply Hamilton from AMD. I know you will represent different components of surgery, so you are welcome to make input. So Janelle will not be making its submission, it's part of the subject. So this is a pleasure.
Honorable Chairperson, honorable members of this committee, representatives of the Department of Defense, and fellow stakeholders, I think I would like to thank this committee for creating an opportunity for industry to engage with this piece of legislation. And to this end, ensure that at the end of the day, we end up with not only a bill that serves the country's obligations internationally, but also ensure that at the end of the day, we have a military capability which is a right of every country to defend itself, that does so as effectively as what the different bodies of law permit. Madam Chair, you've already noted that the Denel submission is integrated into ours. The process that we followed was basically, despite the fact that the public hearing, the call thereof, was distributed in public media and so on, we also individually engaged each of the various companies, particularly those involved in this type of business, the Denel Munitions of this world, the fuse manufacturers, the Fuchs, and so on. And we are happy that what we are presenting is a fairly representative spectrum of views. I want to state upright and in front of, or before we even begin, that we have no principled objections to the intentions of the bill. The idea is to make the bill as practical as possible, to make sure that it does not prohibit legitimate research and development work, particularly on what could be perceived to be dual-use technologies, but also that it does not proscribe companies that are involved, particularly in humanitarian activities, removing these same type of munitions and leave them exposed legally to prosecution because of how we have worded certain elements of the bill. So I would also maybe, if it is not out of line, Madam Chairperson, on the issue of cluster munitions, there are different types. Those that can be used as area weapons to cover as much of the surface area as possible, but those that are used to defeat a specific target. In fact, I would say a specific pinpoint munition. If you've got a rocket coming at you, you are sitting in a tank. You cannot respond with another pinpoint projectile. So because of the response time, because of the probability of missing this rocket, you end up with a cluster munition that not only explodes but spreads, covering a certain area so that it diffuses the specific projectile. So there are different types, and I would urge, unfortunately, Madam Chair, we, for some reason, seem not to be part of some of the deliberations where some of these things are discussed. But it is important that we do that, engage industry so that we can, when we choose, also discriminate, so to speak, between those that are legitimate and acceptable for use and those that we want to restrict. So there are different types of cluster munitions, and I wouldn't want us to take it blanketly in this regard. I will proceed, Madam Chair, with your permission.
It will be important for you because if we have to speak to it in the legislation, then we will need to be very clear as to which cluster munition I'm referring to. But in this case, we're referring to in terms of the usage of it towards a target. In this case, not being able to discriminate between combatants and civilians. There are cases where it was not used towards covering a certain landscape, but it was used to a science. And if it happens, what do we say? What is the legislation placed on it? You know, it's not about the manufacturing thereof. I think we need to be clear on that, so that everybody understands that the bill's intention is not to deregulate usage of cluster munitions, but the usage thereof needs to be very specific. But there's legal implications and legal requirements of adherence. But I think we'll talk about that when we engage at the level. But you are free to clarify. I think this is the only chance you have to say everything you want to say. So don't leave out any important aspect you want to clarify about your industry.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. Without further ado, I will commence then with the presentation itself. I will also commence with a small apology. These things were sent through for printing in the small hours of the morning, so on the second page you have a scope that is inappropriate to this presentation. Please ignore it. The purpose is to articulate the response of the defense industry to the specific bill, and we will do so for the benefit. I found it necessary, Madam Chair, for the benefit of other stakeholders who may not have engaged with AMD before, to just have two or three things on AMD specifically and then move on to the bill. I hope it is not received negatively. So we'll do so with a brief introduction on AMD, and then address the specific responses to the aspects of the bill and then close. As an association, we are an independent Section 21 company, not-for-profit, funded fully by industry. And for the primary purpose that I believe that all of South Africans should also support, for the primary purpose of ensuring that we have a sustainable and responsible defense industry within the imperatives that this government set at different times. We have a board of directors that direct what we do, and we are recognized by both the DTI and the Department of Defense as a representative association of the industry. While some might say having 44 companies in one association sounds like a small club, we represent, in fact, the majority of the defense business in this country, ranging from all the big companies to the smallest of the companies across all capabilities, land, air, and sea, as well as defense electronics, manufacturing, and maintenance. And we contribute, minimal as it might be, to this country's economic well-being as well as skills capacity. Some of our scientists are doing work in areas in non-defense that they would not have been able to do had it not been for the work that they have done in the defense environment. To this end, we view ourselves as a responsible member of the international community, and therefore we adhere to the various dictates that are found in the body of law, including, amongst others, conventional arms control, non-proliferation, and similar legislatives, the Mine Plan Treaty, Foreign Military Assistance Act, including this one that we are discussing today. Further, in an attempt to ensure compliance by industry, some of the companies, if not most, have got in response to the need for government to ensure compliance, and in order to make sure that we don't waste too much time when we interact with government in various areas, internal arms control procedures in the companies that ensure that when we eventually take an application to NCACC, we have at least covered bases from the industry side. And then further, we commit ourselves to abiding to a code of conduct as members of the defense industry, which is supportive of all these bodies of law that I have referred to. And I now move on to the actual issues in the bill itself. And as I've said, there are no principles of objections. It is issues around definitions and how we conceptualize specific concepts. On the issue of a military objective, we fear that the definition as it currently stands, by including the word object, it might lead to a degree of confusion in the interpretation and the intended meaning thereof. And our submission is that the word be replaced with objective, or that the objective should be added to the clause after the word object. I have received a somewhat competing or dissenting view from one individual who is an interested member, a former military person, who actually pointed out that the definition was correct in terms of military applications and therefore should be left as such. I will leave that to be the prerogative of the military practitioners, Madam Chair. Secondly, on procurement or purchase.
Well, you see, this is our territory now. I don't know to which extent the military practitioners are. We will want to know what you mean by inclusion of objectives. This is what they say, it's an object. Now, you should have brought your lawyer along, you see, so that you explain yourself. If you can't, you must go back home and bring your lawyer, and then you compare what they have said, what you are saying, and what our lawyer will say. You see? So let's hear why do you want us to put this object after object or remove object? Without referring to them, they will defend their case, you defend your case.
Madam Chair, it is more an issue around interpretation, that using the two words in the same sentence or in the definition one of the other could lead to confusion of interpretation. A military objective, in our view, remains a military objective, and an object might be both military or civilian. And so our view was that the confusion can be dealt with by removing the word object and replacing it with objective. So I think it is a matter of probably then eventually in this discussion us agreeing on what is a mutually understood terminology in that definition, so to speak. Okay. The second definition that we identified is the one that relates with procuring of these munitions. Again, there is a word that includes discovery. Now, discovery as a word or as a verb is a bit of a misnomer, because is it while you are sitting in your laboratory configuring various systems that you discover something, or is it while you are walking down the street that you pick up an object that is described in this bit? And once again, it's an issue of interpretation and an issue of unduly exposing even civilians to picking up objects and therefore being found to be in contradiction of this law and therefore being liable for prosecution. So it's an issue of terminology in terms of how we use it. The issue of transfer, another definition as well. Some of our companies are involved in demining activities, humanitarian and otherwise. When you come across munitions that the bill seeks to restrict or prohibit, you would become subject to prosecution simply because you have come across them and have engaged with them in an effort to either defuse them or deal with them otherwise. And it's again a plea on our side that we do not prevent industry from doing its work while we are trying to meet our international obligations as a country. So the bill should make clear and executable and possible provision of how legitimate and lawful possession, as in the case of the companies, or transfer of the prohibited weapons will be regulated. We're not saying it must not be regulated, it must be, but it must not be done in a manner that opens industry to prosecution unduly. On the issue of a person, we feel that the word person is used indiscriminately in this regard, no pun intended. There is not a clear delineation of legal persons generally, and I think we would want the definition to become a bit more specific and also to be included in the definitions, because it is not. And so probably it's because it's not included in the definitions that it becomes usable so easily in the text itself. With regard to component parts, this relates specifically to the fact that a specific component part, say a fuse, might be used in more than one weapon system or munition. The result for that is that if we, on a blanket basis, prohibit and restrict everything here, we might actually create a situation where we are unable to use certain component parts in other areas. In fact, throughout this body of law, there is also a category of elements that are referred to as dual use technologies and components, which have application not only in several military areas, but also in both the military and civilian sector. And therefore, we need to be very clear when we pass this bill that we do not make life more difficult for ourselves than what it probably already is in certain areas. So we have suggested a definition. The key element there is that the bill specifically says that it is designed and adapted to form an essential and integral part. I think That is a crucial qualification on the part of the bill, because it isolates it to the specific munitions that the bill seeks to restrict. But we suggested an alternative definition, slightly modified, to actually include that discrimination, because in the definition in the text, that element that says essential and integral part is left out. So I think it's an important one. It allows us to continue to use technologies that are otherwise beneficial, but also associated with similar munitions. On the issue of mines, booby traps, and other devices, we believe these are sufficiently addressed in the Mine Ban Treaty and other related protocols. And the question that we would ask is to what extent are we opening ourselves to over-regulation and dilution of what is already contained in other pieces of legislation. So we are basically urging that we don't have a cumbersome legislative process, and that where the Mine Ban Treaty and others are found to be wanting, that we amend those specifically instead of regulating them additionally in other areas. On the issue of stockpiling, manufacture and transfer, which was addressed partly earlier, we would like that to be clearly defined in the bill. It is not clearly defined what it implies, what it means, and we would like to see a better definition at the moment. Blinding laser weapons seem to be a contentious issue across. The same applies. The Mine Ban Treaty exists for the prohibition and control of mines. There is a piece of legislation that addresses the use of blinding laser weapons. And so we would like to either amend that and beef that up specifically and not include them here in this bill, as they are not necessarily or strictly within this ambit. And then lastly, ma'am, which is actually an enforcement issue on clause 10, the mere possession of a specific component or weapon is prosecutable. And there it is merely the industry thinking for not only itself but the ordinary persons on the street, that we need to make sure that we have mechanisms of communicating that this will be the case, that if you are found in possession of this these munitions, you will be prosecuted, and that we give a certain period of amnesty, so that if there are people in possession of these, they have a period within which to return them and receive the necessary amnesty and pardons, and not be prosecuted. Because if we implement this today and there are people who have it, it means we basically make them criminals immediately. So let us, in complying with international law, make sure that we don't criminalize our own people and industry in that regard as well. The other comments, Madam Honorable Chairperson, are primarily of a general nature that seek to make sure that the bill does not become hamstrung with minor technical issues here and there. We have addressed, I think, what other members of Parliament have raised in terms of to what extent are other countries also signing up to this bill and committing to a similar level of compliance. There it speaks to the fact that we should never be left, particularly from an R&D point of view as well from a dual use point of view, we should not be left naked, so to speak. We should remain with certain capabilities that we as a nation find appropriate to retain. And that directive will come from the political establishment and the military establishment in terms of the objectives and mandates that they have. There is the issue around government-funded research. Much of the research that we do is funded by government, and so industry will never engage in any activities that are not sanctioned by the South African government. And so therefore it becomes important that the government gives the guidance in this regard, and we plead for that as well, Madam Chair. And then lastly, some of the work that is done in humanitarian fields is done outside of South Africa. The bill has got an extra terrestrial application outside of South Africa. And we would want probably a short indication of how those members of industry who are engaged in those type of activities are protected from undue prohibition in this regard as well. So to this end, Madam Chair, we want to reiterate our support for the government in meeting its international obligations, being a responsible state, so to speak, And we would like to just merely ensure that the practicality of the bill is in place, that it can be used in a manner that we are all comfortable with, that we don't encroach in other existing dictates and instruments of law. We have clear definition on which we all agree. And then lastly, we do not prevent unduly in this regard research and development that is legitimate, as well as the use of dual use technologies. I thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Very concerned and prepared. Honourable members, Honourable Munarin, you noted Honourable
Yes, thank you, Mr. Hamilton. I think there was reference made by yourself in your presentation around the Military Assistance Act, the Foreign Military Assistance Act. We did come up with the prohibition of national activities in a bill. Maybe you make that reference especially because maybe there's no clarity on it being ascended to by the president. But our impression is that it has replaced this one. So maybe we can discuss that one if we agree. Then the second point is that you see the issue around preservation of new technology. I'm sure that is your terrain and your field. I'm sure that you can give an advice around that. Just good advice. There will be. Well, in my mind, I'm looking at what you represent, South African defense-related industry, where when it's spread, it's international industry. And it means you represent the military industrial complex, the troops.
I think I can't
only South African companies. No, it is. In the introduction and explaining the objective, there is a very international relationship. Because industry cannot survive on its own. And therefore it becomes a monopoly in industry. In the world, so it's linked, yeah. And obviously, it's business, it's strictly business related, and it being business related, it seeks at the maximization of profits. So those issues, when you look at the fears raised here, those fears reflect correctly that if this bill, this is that is affected, that it will impact on what the industry has acquired over the years. And it will inhibit all the making sure that the industry maximizes its profit. Make sure the light knows what you have to answer that one. You won't say it clearly, but it's just an observation I'm making. But I'm saying, obviously, I agree with you on the number of points which you raised around the definitions, especially the issue around the components. If a component chemical, even if it's out of an entire product, there is 1% or a minimal 4%. If we infect the bill as it is, obviously, if a person is found in possession of that, then it means that person is liable for prosecution. So, I agree with you that we need to be careful in our definitions and how do we capture them. So as we can reach the ultimate objective of making sure that we desist from accumulating weapons which will affect superfluous injury to persons or individuals. That principle should be kept and guarded, not jealously. All other issues around your observations and your conclusions, Because you are worried about the practicality, you are worried about prevention of undue encroachment of existing instruments, and the clarity of definitions. Then your impediment on your R&D, you see, and the actual dual use of what you have, like, we do talk of nuclear weapons, where at one level we have nuclear weapons, which gets used by countries for destructive purposes. And at the same time, what countries like South Africa are using nuclear energy for social and economic interventions. So I'm just saying that definition should make sure that it doesn't take away that capability, such that even if we fear that we will one day be involved in a war. And at the same time, the issues around the weapons of mass destruction have caused a lot of confusion in the world, such that so many countries of the world, or few countries of the world, which are powerful, have a lot of paranoia around whether South Africa or Iran or anywhere else this weapon called the weapon of mass destruction. So I'm sure that the objective and the intention of the bill is making sure that you simply restrict, because one needs to underline that at one level we prohibit, at another level we restrict. So if there is a necessity for complete prohibition, stop producing this, we say that. At a certain level we regulate control, such that we don't deny ourselves an opportunity for research and development in terms of our countries we want. So I'm just saying that a lot of issues you raise are not necessarily controversial. They don't minus or omit the important objectives or intentions of what the bill wish to achieve. So, if I'm not correct, then we can say that these are the issues specifically which we, as the industry, felt that whatever this decision we have to be implemented is going to contain us from moving forward in terms of our business, or the main core of our business.
Thank you,
Chair, and thank you to Mr. Hamilton for a very clear, precise presentation to the point. I think you made a very strong case for we should not neglect research and development. I think what is important for this committee is when you leave on behalf of the friend industry, that there is no detrimental effect of this bill if it comes into law on the defense industry. That's the insurance we want from AND in the last instance. You made an extremely important sentence in one of your columns when you on your general comments to say it is our duty as Parliament to make sure that this convention is converted or brought into law, but to make sure that it's implemented in a fair manner globally and across the signatories in this regard. That's an extremely important issue. That's our job to make sure that happens. So I'm very glad that you mentioned it. In the beginning of your presentation, you, as a side remark, referred to the cluster munitions, and you made the distinction between a pinpoint and a general one, and to say we should be sensitive to not to which one we want to regulate and which one we want to allow. Can I link up with the previous question of Mr. Diali and also the chair to the ICRC and put it differently to you, just to get your view? If opposing forces to our military, the SANDF, do use weapons that is prohibited in this bill against us, what then? If other people use conventional weapons against us. We cannot regulate other countries or other people or other organizations. What is your considered view on this one? Thank you.
Thank you. I know it's good.
Thanks, sir. Indeed, we cannot actually regulate you. We can't regulate your enemy on how you must fight you. That's why you're enemy. My question, adding a tail to what the Honorable Boranoff has said, but my question, I just wanted to find out. I read something that, you know, history is also an interesting subject. Just before the Cold War, or immediately after the Cold War, I think in the 90s, what happened, you saw U.S. in particular. No, U.S. recruiting.
Honorable Julie, you cannot say, you can't say the black woman in the bank. Clarify yourself. But
no, then you say the collapse of the Cold War. That's why.
The collapse of the Cold War.
Okay. Are you saying that?
I'm saying in 1990, around that time, the collapse of the Soviet Union. So, the some scientists recruited from the east to the west. And as that was happening, more pronouncements being made that the bipolar thing is now over. Now, presumably for the unipolar. The skills that have been there, you know, because this thing, the guys who produce these things we're talking about, the slaves and all complicated things, for me, historian, I can't, but I also learned that it takes time to nature them, to produce these scientists, people are skilled, so on and so forth. Now, to your industry that you are leading, or at least you are working with, I want to find out, what will be the implications of this bill, you know, in now ensuring that, I'm not talking about now the substance, I'm talking about the human training, and the capability, because when a thing erupts today, you can't just say, Benjamin, go and mix oil and water to produce X. First, you must have taught a person how to do that. So I'm interested in now the capability in terms of the human, you know, teaching or training. To say, how do you look like in your industry? Or were you also poached at the time, or you are also poaching? You may use your discretion to answer. Thank you.
Thanks,
sir.
Any other questions?
Maybe I should also compliment Mr. Emerson for his presentation. I will follow on the route taken by Noble Mercy here. That the skills, the people who developed this weapons, their skills are still needed even if we try to solve the skills. I want us to look at this thing in terms of economy. Because of the countries, all the countries are having their own secrecy. They are developing weapons which are not known, even though they are the signatories of the protocols and so on. And then those weapons will only be seen in times of war. They cannot be seen now. Now, as the war erupts, we should be in a position to say that these people who are skilled, they can develop these things. I'm saying that in terms of economy, looking at the foreign, my example would be Korea, North Korea, or even Iran. They have developed a nuclear weapon. And then the whole world has been making noise about that. And all of a sudden, it's been used for economic purposes. They say, we can stop this, provided you uplift sanctions, you start dealing, you start doing your business with us, then you can solve this thing. Knowing that there's the skills, the knowledge is there, and then now the structure using it for economic reasons. Now we should also look at our skills.
are we going to just diminish them, or are we going to reserve them, preserve them for future?
Thank you. Any other member who wants to speak? Double skipper.
Yes, Chair, I'm just catch up or put up in a clarity seeking thing. In your dialogue between, in the very beginning, Mr. Hamilton referred to the manufacturing of the ammunition. And you said now the bill doesn't intend to, but on the use of this. But now I'm referring to clause 10. It says in the possession of. And I just want clarity from Mr. Hamilton. Clarity in terms of the great risk this bill has. And he made a suggestion that the Portfolio Committee and the Defense and the Department of Defense create mechanisms to inform the South African public, especially the SADRI, the South African defense-related industry, of the potential risk. So I just want to find out from him, what is this potential risk that he is referring to, and some of the mechanisms we can use to inform the public, South African public. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Some of the questions will not necessarily have to be directed to the presenters because they are not the ones who will tackle the bill. I'm going to give to our legal advisors, especially the ones from DOD, just to clarify in terms of definition, especially the 10, as one of them, also the issue of the under military objective, the issue of the object, which I believe was an issue that needed to be discussed. And then the extraterritoriality, and explaining what is the detrimental effect that can be there, especially as you're saying, referring to the industry. Then we can have a discussion, we'll then receive a response from Mr. Amitabh Bhattacharya. Can we have that from Mr. Dada and Mr. Tigera?
Thank you very much, Chair. I will deal with the issue of surrender under clause 10. And perhaps I will attempt to deal with the issue of the definition of military objective as raised by Mr. Hamilton. Firstly, Chair, if one reads clause 10 as a whole, one will pick that the clause itself is intended exactly to prevent what Mr. Hamilton was referring to. Because in the clause, we've built in some kind of a transitional mechanism to ensure that once the deal has been passed and it comes into operation, you do not immediately criminalize possession of those weapons without giving those people an opportunity, reasonable opportunity for them to comply with the law. Hence, we prescribe a period of 6 months for those people to hand over those prohibited weapons. So I believe that issue is catered for. But I think the concern to the industry will be largely with relation to issue of possession in general, because they may be in possession, I think it's somewhere in the submission, that they may be in the possession for purposes of destruction or disposal. How do you deal with those issues? Because in their submission, they refer to issues that in some instances they are involved in demining activities. And for that purpose, they may have to be in possession of weapons for purposes of destruction and all that. So I think we need to gather our thoughts around this issue, how we can ensure that we don't criminalize the noble activities that they are conducting as an industry with regard to issues of demining. I do not know, Chair, going forward, how you intend to deal with this. Perhaps if there will be an opportunity where you will give the department to reply, perhaps we can come up with ideas as to how we can cater for the industry with regard to the issue of possession. Chair, then I move to the issue of military objective. If you look at the definition in the convention itself and in the bill, there is one definition that deals with civilian objects. Now, it defines civilian objects as objects which are not military objectives in the convention. Then you have the definition of military objective. Now, as I understood, the concern from the industry is that they look at military objectives as something that should be distinct from a civilian object. Now, the way we see it is that military objective is about a goal, but the goal you relate to a civilian, to an object. Now, you may have a military objective which would be the goal to destroy a particular military installation. Not necessarily an object, because a military object could be any institution that has the capability for the military. But here the protocol specifically refers to the military objective as a goal, in as far as it relates to an object. So I think that's where the confusion is. Perhaps we need again to see how we can improve on that. But what we have tried is that in the bill, what we have tried to do is to ensure that we do not deviate from the definitions that are in the convention for compliance purposes. But if that creates confusion, perhaps we can go back and see how we can improve on that definition. And I think I will give to my colleague to see if he can amplify on some of the issues.
Yes, but on the same issue, compliance is one thing, but if the definition itself can criminalize our industry, will we just comply for the sake of compliance and then put our own industries out of participation in the mainstream? I think we need to clarify so that when they leave here, they are very clear as to what then we mean by this object. The way you explain it, I think suffices, but if it has to be explained in terms of compliance, then it will still remain an issue of confusion. And that's what that we must clarify, because I don't think it's only an element of confusion, but also an element of legislation for our own sake as a country. So we need to be very clear on that part. Maybe what I need to do is to give the department an opportunity to listen to all the inputs and then go back and prepare a submission. And when we converse next Tuesday, we give you an opportunity to present before we continue with the discussions, because next week we'll discuss the bill. And the reason being that we only have six submissions, so we don't have much time to discuss the six submissions, especially when there are clear proposals that are being made. We'll only focus our attention on the proposals. I think that's one thing, but if the department will not be able to respond to those issues now, I think we can. So Mr. Hamilton, you will use the discussion whether to come or to hear from us how we proceed forward. But you can continue and plan.
Chairperson, thank you so much. I think on the issue of the implications of the bill to the industry, I think it's a point that is very important. But I think an understanding that needs to be reinforced is an understanding that says this bill tackles about two categories of weapons. On the one hand, it restricts the use of certain weapons, and on the other, it prohibits. And as you can see, that when it comes to matters of restriction, the industry, insofar as restrictions are concerned, I think they are not affected at all, because issues of R&D, issues of design and all of that are not affected. But where maybe the implication could be is when we're talking about matters of prohibition, because there will be higher standards of saying you may not manufacture, stockpile, and do all sorts of things. But in the case of a deal related to anti-personnel mines, I think Ms. Hamilton would know that the Anti-Personnel Mines Prohibition Bill, it makes provision there that says the Minister of Defense would give certain permission to certain industry who are dealing with anti-personnel mines, because in terms of that particular convention, the Defense Department is still entitled to train itself around the techniques of anti-personnel mines. And as such, therefore, such techniques lie with the industry. And the minister has specific powers to exempt certain sectors of the industry who are dealing in that particular aspect. Maybe then, Chairperson, we can consider to take that particular provision and put it here, that in instances where the industry would be required to be in possession of certain categories of weapons for purposes of research and for purposes of assisting Defense Department in terms of its own military mandate, such sectors of industry could be exempt. I think that is an idea that we can try to incorporate into this bill. But obviously, Chairperson would love to respond much more substantially after we've tried to consider these inputs very carefully.
But I need to bring to your attention what has made people to ask such questions. If you look at clause 10, excuse me, 1, it says any person in possession of any prohibited weapon in itself, it doesn't mention whether it's talking about the industry or an individual. It says any person. So the wording itself is a problem. Because if you say any person, it's nothing discriminating of the industry. It says anybody who is in possession. It doesn't matter who it is. So I think we have to look into that wording, because that's where the problem is. Because it suggests that everybody, including industry, as long as you're a person, whether you're a natural person or not, but it's ambiguous the way it is stated. But we look into that. I think we'll Honorable Munale.
Also, the other question, I think Hamilton raised the issue that a defense force has the right, or it possesses the right, to mine in its military base. You know, if you want to defend yourself, you want to prohibit or stop encroachment into a military base. From where I come from, all military bases have their own minefields, such that an enemy cannot encroach into the base. So if clause 10 says that any person found in possession of a restricted or prohibited weapons, well, what does it mean? Because those people who mine are sappers, or they are engineers who have the full latitude and the right to do that activity. At what point will they be found in possession of that? I wouldn't know, but if I am an officer, law enforcement officer, then I find that person and I read it at a bill, then what it means is that I've got all the right to arrest that person. You get my point? The bill doesn't say you get permission from the defense force or from a senior commander of the base. I don't say that. So maybe the legal team and department will assist us such that we don't find ourselves in an unfortunate situation. There are people who, you know, there was a mistake around when you love an AK-47, you lack it. Then what you do, you stop its, what do you call it? You know, there is automatic fire in an AK-47, which when you use it, it's very devastating. But if you are a weapon collector, you can take away those firing capabilities, and from there, keep it in your house. That's my point. But in terms of the Act, Firearms Act, there are a lot of problems in making a difference between your firearms collectors and those people who are stockpiling weapons with intention to come up with something under the state.
Honorable Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity again. I think what Mr. Gaza has managed to do, which is what I was going to partially address as part of my answers, has been to elaborate on a provision, a mechanism that will do precisely or at least partially what we would want to see happen with regards to R&D. The industrial capabilities that are engaged in R&D on the mine then, or on the mining side, are basically controlled and housed within a division called Defense, Peace, Safety and Security within the CSIR. They sit at Bargefontein in a very controlled area, and their work is to make sure that we can even use mine-related technology to test vehicles. So there's an additional application which is not just the mere R&D around mines, but also the testing of vehicles to comply with, you know, being armored for specific types of mines. And then there is the additional application that Mr. Dada referred to, which is should the National Department of Defense need to protect itself against mines in future. That same capability allows you to do that. And I think this is the type of provision and mechanism we would want to see included in this bill so that we are able to continue with research and development. We are able to develop countermeasures in this regard, but we are also able to use this in various certain evaluation activities of systems that are meant to protect our people against others who use similar prohibited types of technologies. And I think that one provision answers several questions that were asked here. What happens when an opponent uses something like that? If you don't have this R&D capability, you will not be able to protect yourself. In fact, should you make a drastic decision that says you need to use similar means for whatever reason, if you do not make provision to have the R&D capability there, you will not be able within the amount of time available to establish that capability and be able to use it against an opponent who's using it. So I think it addresses that one question. Madam Chair, I'll just try and go through some of the questions very briefly that was asked or that we asked, and then we will on my side be finished with your permission. And the preservation of technology as raised by Honorable Munareng, the mechanism provides for that. If we structure it, package it in a manner that is not restrictive and allows us to engage in bona fide research and development activities, I think we will go a long way. On the impact of profits, on profits, Honorable Munareng, I represent the South African defense-related industries and no one else, with due respect, Honorable Member. Yes, our companies have a degree of foreign ownership, part of which is sanctioned by the South African government, if not all of it. And even Denel is going through a similar activity of finding foreign equity partners. Our interests are not on, primarily when we engage on issues of this nature, are not on profit maximization, but on retaining capabilities that allow us to do certain things as already articulated in my opening address a moment ago. No link with the if we make the provisions already addressed, I would think that the fear of the detrimental effect of industry on industry, because we're dealing with R&D, number one. So if we make those provisions, that is acceptable. If we start dealing with issues around operational practicality, when an operator in a company, for instance, like Mechan, that is involved in demining, and finds themselves in possession of this, we need to make those provisions as well, so that, as we've agreed, we do not criminalize industry while it pursues, in fact, humanitarian activities that are acceptable under international law, in assisting to rehabilitate tracts of land and make it possible for civilians to go back to those tracts of land. So we should be careful not to criminalize that. So in terms of the impact, I think if we address these concerns, the impact will be either minimal or not be as negative as what many of us have feared up to now. I wish to reiterate that it is indeed the duty of Parliament to make sure that as a country we are not left somewhat naked. We need to make sure that when we go into international arrangements, that those arrangements apply almost reciprocal in how they are applied as well. I'm not sure if there's anyone whose questions I have not answered, Madam Chair. The last comment I would like to make is with regard to who is made responsible for monitoring, implementing, and enforcing the provisions of this bill. I think as industry we have no objections to one of the suggestions that the Armed Control Commission be given this onerous task. What is important though is that we ensure that it is not unduly overstressed. I think in the long run, if you keep on adding responsibilities onto an institution that you are not capacitating from underneath, you will sit with an overstressed institution that is not able to fulfill all its responsibilities as optimally as what it can. So we would support the use of the of an existing body if its mandate is extended and it is properly resourced to do so and capacitated to do so. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mr.
Well, you should have a foreign general.
Yeah. Honorable members, are you hungry?
Sorry.
Are you very, very hungry? Honorable members, you've got 10 minutes. In fact, we're late. We're supposed to be 40 minutes into our lunch. Let's take the two hands. We'll wrap up, then we break for lunch. Lunch served here at the good old session.
No, I hope you didn't answer the question. The reference is made in this presentation on the Foreign Military Assistance Act.
Honorable Tuli?
And also on the skills, the personnel that goes with the capability in the training. How is it?
Well, I thought the latter was responded to, but maybe then we need more adequate explanation or a different approach to the answer. Honorable members, you've done well in the morning. I don't know whether you are hungry or what is happening. So you two decide just to go haywire for now. Let us have. The latter was responded to, but I think you can try to approach it differently. Mr. Vanara, you might come back in after lunch and mix up three people. And Ms. Marikisa, we'll take you after lunch, if that is okay. Okay. Yes, you are on the program after lunch. Thank you. Maybe you should have a copy of the program. Mr. Amitri?
Honorable Chairperson, thank you. I think one has to confess to a degree of ignorance. I am not certain if the Foreign Military Assistance Act has extended eventually. If it has not been, it's another issue. If it has, we support the intention of the Foreign Military Assistance Act to the extent that it does not achieve exactly some of the concepts, or it does not lead to some of the concerns that we have already addressed here of preventing industry to carry out its duties as deployed in various environments or contracted in various environments. So I think, Honorable Munarren, I would probably need to do a bit of homework and make sure that in future when I refer to an act, I know what its status is. With regard to R&D and skills, Madam Chair, I think the provision that is mooted in this regard in terms of making sure that we do not prohibit research in this area will also ensure that we retain some of the skills. Maybe not all of them, because if you are not just researching but also engaged in manufacturing, production, prototypes, etc., your skill base is even wider. So it basically means that it will narrow the skill base that is specific to this area of expertise, but at least it does not emaciate it entirely and lead to absolutely no skills available, which means that those people will have to find employment elsewhere. And I don't know how this country controls the recruitment of its scientists by other countries. I will leave that to the legislature, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's all break for lunch, and we're all invited to lunch in the good old restaurant. Thank you. Honorable members, excuse me, We need to have a very short lunch because my office has failed to inform Ceasefire campaign that they are now presenting in the afternoon. And Mr. Yes, so Mr. Thompson needs to fly back. So we'll need you to have lunch for half an hour, please. If you can finish lunch by 20 past 1.
there, but my only reason I'm saying is in the Gadda Omba. And